White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Well, good evening, listeners and students of Henry Ford's The International Jew. This is episode 5 tonight and chapter 4 that we'll be covering. It's July 26, 2012. Your hosts are Hadding Scott and me, Carolyn Yeager. I've got that big smile on my face again. It really is amazing how that music works on me. So, Hadding, hello. And we've got a rather long chapter tonight, don't we?
Well, it's a little longer than the last one. Not terribly long.
No, but next week is going to be chapter 5. This is chapter 4. Chapter 5 is going to be even longer. So I was thinking we will probably need 3 programs to do these 2 chapters. So if we don't quite finish this one tonight, it's all right because we can finish next week and then we will spend 2 weeks. We'll have 2 weeks for the next one. So we won't. I was thinking, gee, are we going to have to forget commenting and just read? But we can still make our comments. And this is an interesting chapter. Not as interesting maybe as next week is going to be, but it's pretty interesting. The Jewish question, fact or fancy? So why don't you just start right in with it?
All right. It begins with a quote. "The Jewish question still exists. It would be useless to deny it. The Jewish question exists wherever Jews live in perceptible numbers. Where it does not exist, it is carried by Jews in the course of their migrations. We naturally move to those places where we are not persecuted, and there our presence produces persecution. The unfortunate Jews are now carrying anti-Semitism into England. They have already introduced it into America." That's Theodor Herzl, one of the founders of Zionism, in his book Der Judenstaat, A Jewish State, and it's said to be on page 4.
Yeah, now here I already have a little question here. He's interesting that this is Herzl saying that the Jews are carrying anti-Semitism into England. They've already introduced it into America. It's always kind of thought that first the Jews went to England and then America, but he's not talking about the Jews. Well, he's talking about anti-Semitism. How do you interpret that?
Well, I haven't looked into Jewish immigration to the UK, but I suppose that since they didn't have the tradition of being a land of immigrants or that myth, they may have been a little slower to accept all the Jews that wanted to leave Russia.
There really aren't that many Jews in the UK. And so the fact that what I'm really thinking about is that earlier Judification in England and amongst the upper classes and how the English, because of commerce and so on, how the Jews got in there so tight and so many of them have aristocratic titles and they don't even have Jewish names anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what I'm thinking of. But I guess as far as these immigrants go, according to him, they came into America first and then started going to England.
Well, there were some new Russian Jew immigrants in the UK in the late 19th century. One of the prominent suspects as Jack the Ripper is a Jew. A Russian Jew immigrant.
That's right. That's right. I have read about that, but I don't remember it all that well. But
and the suppressed, this was supposedly suppressed because they didn't want an outbreak of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, who suppressed it? The British suppressed it, huh? Because they didn't want an outbreak of anti-Semitism.
Police and a lot of Freemasons in the police, and Jews have a lot of clout with Freemasonry, so that's probably how it works. My guess.
That's a good guess. All right.
Yeah. All right. The Jewish question, fact or fancy. The chief difficulty in writing about the Jewish question is the supersensitiveness of Jews and non-Jews concerning the whole matter. There is a vague feeling that even to openly use the word Jew or to expose it nakedly to print is somehow improper. Polite evasions like Hebrew and Semite, both of which are subject to the criticism of inaccuracy, are timidly essayed, and people pick their way gingerly as if the whole subject were forbidden, until some courageous Jewish thinker comes straight out with the good old word Jew, and then the constraint is relieved and the air cleared. The word Jew is not an epithet. It is a name, ancient and honorable, with significance for every period of human history, past, present, and to come.
Okay. We'll let that go.
Well, if you want to.
Well, you want to say something because he keeps going on with it a little bit further, a little bit more.
All right.
You know.
There is extreme sensitiveness about the public discussion of the Jewish question on the part of Gentiles. They would prefer to keep it in the hazy borderlands of their thought, shrouded in silence. Their heritage of tolerance has something to do with their attitude, but perhaps their instinctive sense of the difficulty involved has more to do with it. The principal public Gentile pronouncements upon the Jewish question are in the manner of the truckling politician or the pleasant after-dinner speaker. The great Jewish names in philosophy, medicine, literature, music, and finance are named over. The energy, ability, and thrift of the race are dwelt upon. And everyone goes home feeling that a difficult place has been rather neatly negotiated. But nothing is changed thereby. The Jew is not changed. The Gentile is not changed. The Jew still remains the enigma of the world.
Well, I will say that one of my most powerful experiences or changes in my thinking was when I realized in some special moment that, and I've said this too many times already, but that the word that I was afraid to use the word Jew, I always had been and everybody else was, and that we had to say Jewish, you know, you always had to say a Jewish person instead of a Jew. And then that just, I just became aware of that and made me very angry. And so this is so true. I mean, it's so true that people are, we have become this idea that, so that's, I think, why he's saying, oh, the word Jew is the Jews are an honorable people, they blah, blah. There should be nothing about that word Jew that should make people think, oh, that's a word nobody should say in public. So they're kind of bringing out, I think, the contradiction here that they're going to continue talking about.
Well, we even have this verb in English, to Jew somebody out of something.
Yes, well, you mentioned, I think you've mentioned that before. And that's true, but when did that come about? I mean, we have all these things about
probably
Jews.
Old.
Yeah.
Probably rather old. And I think the word Jew has had a bad connotation for a long time. There's a hostile exchange in Shakespeare where somebody says, "Thou juvenile, thou Jew."
That's why they want to change Shakespeare, the Jews. You know, if the Jews really get the control they want, they will get rid of everything, all this stuff, and they will get rid of Wagner and Shakespeare. And, you know, it's just a horrible thing to contemplate. But so the idea is that the word they try to cover over it by, he said, in these when people gather together talking about how fine the Jews are and so on, then they all feel more comfortable about it because they don't know what to do about the knowledge that we all have that the Jews are not fine and wonderful people, and it's difficult. It just puts this difficulty.
Well,
we all have to go ahead.
Another part of it is the idea of an enlightenment society like the United States. This all men are created equal stuff really has the air let out of it if you start recognizing ethnic and racial differences as not superficial, but as essential. In other words, when you refer to a Jew by the noun Jew instead of saying a Jewish person, you're saying that this is essentially what he is. He is essentially a Jew. That is his nature. It is not something external and accidental.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think this does come out in this chapter a little bit later, so let's go on. That was good.
All right. Gentile sensitiveness on this point is best expressed by the desire for silence. Why discuss it at all, is the attitude. Such an attitude is itself a proof that there is a problem which we would evade if we could. Why discuss it at all? The keen thinker clearly sees in the implications of such a question the existence of a problem whose discussion or suppression will not always be within the choice of easygoing minds. Is there a Jewish question in Russia? Unquestionably, in its most virulent form. Is it necessary to meet that question in Russia? Undoubtedly. Meet it from every angle along which light and healing may come. Well, the percentage of the Jewish population of Russia is just 1% more than it is in the United States. The majority of the Jews themselves are not less well-behaved in Russia than they are here. They lived under restrictions which do not exist here. Yet in Russia, their genius has enabled them to attain a degree of power which has completely baffled the Russian mind. Whether you go to Romania, Russia, Austria, or Germany, or anywhere else that the Jewish question has come to the forefront as a vital issue, you will discover that the principal cause is the outworking of the Jewish genius to achieve the power of control. The outworking. Here in the United States, it is the fact of this remarkable minority, a sparse Jewish ingredient of 3% in a nation of 110 million, attaining in 50 years a degree of control that would be impossible to a 10 times larger group of any other race, that creates the Jewish question here. 3% of any other people would scarcely occasion comment, because we could not meet with a representative of them wherever we went in high places. In the innermost secrecy of the councils of the Big Four at Versailles, in the Supreme Court, in the councils of the White House, in the vast dispositions of world finance, wherever there is power to get or use. Yet we meet the Jew everywhere in the upper circles, literally everywhere there is power. He has the brains, the initiative, the penetrative vision which almost automatically project him to the top. And as a consequence, he is more marked than any other race.
Yeah, marked. Well, they mean marked. That mean more like, in a sense, distinctive. They're more unique to themselves or than any other race.
Distinct.
They stand out. Distinct, yeah. Distinct. That would be it, not distinctive. Yeah.
And
well,
that
now
is
it comes to a good part. Yeah, okay.
Okay, go. Well, did you want to say?
No. Sorry. Go ahead. Sorry.
And that is where the Jewish question begins. It begins in very simple terms. How does the Jew so habitually and so resistlessly gravitate to the highest places? What puts him there? Why is he put there? What does he do there? What does the fact of his being there mean to the world? That is the Jewish question in its origin. From these points, it goes on to others, and whether the trend becomes pro-Jewish or anti-Semitic depends on the amount of prejudice brought to the inquiry. and whether it becomes pro-humanity depends on the amount of insight and intelligence.
Okay, so they defined the Jewish question, you know? I mean, that's, and then we have to remember that the title of the book is The International Jew. So we're going to find in this chapter that he is concerning himself with that particular type of Jew, which, and there's an interesting, there's some interesting comments coming on as to how he defines that, or not he, but how the writers define that. So, but anyway, the Jewish question is how do the Jews become so successful? You know, how do they rise to the top the way they do?
And what do they do when they get there?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
The use of the word humanity in connection with the word Jew usually throws a side meaning which may not be intended. In this connection, it is usually understood that the humanity ought to be shown toward the Jew. There is just as great an obligation upon the Jew to show his humanity toward the whole race. Whole human race, he means. The Jew has been too long accustomed to think of himself as exclusively the claimant on the humanitarianism of society. Society has a large claim against him that he cease his exclusiveness, that he cease exploiting the world, that he cease making Jewish groups the end and all of his gains, and that he begin to fulfill, in a sense his exclusiveness has never yet enabled him to fulfill, the ancient prophecy that through him all the nations of the earth should be blessed.
Yeah.
I found that kind of objectionable, that whole Bible-rooted attitude toward the Jews. I prefer just to discard that.
Well, in a sense, you could just say they're covering all the different kind of things that are thought, but I agree with you. Some of this I don't like.
Also, it's really more of a Protestant and probably Masonic attitude toward the Jews than a traditional Christian attitude, which would be Orthodox or Catholic. Because in the Orthodox and Catholic churches, the old position is that the church now is Israel. That's their view. So the Jews are irrelevant.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the traditional Catholic and Orthodox views.
Well, how it used to be until they've now made their adjustments so they can get along with the Jews. But anyway, that you're right about that.
The Jew cannot go on forever filling the role of suppliant for the world's humanitarianism. A suppliant is like a beggar. He must himself show that quality to a society which seriously suspects his higher and more powerful groups of exploiting it with a pitiless rapacity, which in its wide-flung and long-drawn-out distress may be described as an economic pogrom against a rather helpless humanity. Pogrom. Mm-hmm. For it is true that society is as helpless before the well-organized extortions of certain financial groups as huddled groups of Russian Jews were helpless against the anti-Semitic mob. And as in Russia, so in America, it is the poor Jew who suffers for the delinquencies of the rich exploiter of his race.
Gee, who else talks about this? Who else today talks about the Jew? There's a lot of part Jewish people who say the Jews are the ones who are being most exploited by the Zionists.
Yeah.
It's similar to that, isn't it?
It's what Jonathan Bowden called the reverse semiotic, trying to turn around the enemy's rhetoric.
Yeah. Well, they kind of do that here. I mean, they want to distinguish the poor Jew. Well, you know, there were poor Jews then. There were a lot of poor Jews. There were all these new immigrants and so on. They were poor. Now they're not. Things have changed already from the time this was written in 1920. Well, maybe close to almost 100 years now. ago. They're not poor anymore. I don't know any poor Jews. There might be some working class Jews, a few of them, but they're sure not poor.
A German friend commented to me that most of the billionaires in the United States are Jews.
Oh, that's true. I mean, the number of Jews amongst them, even if it's 40%, that's way too high, but I think it's higher than, I think it's over 50%.
He says it's a majority.
Yeah, I think that's true. And when it
that's a lot of money available for Jewish causes.
And that's where it all goes, too. Nowhere else.
I'm sure a lot of it does. This series of articles is already being met by an organized barrage by mail and wire and voice, every single item of which carries the wail of persecution. One would think that a heartless and horrible attack were being made on a most pitiable and helpless people, until one looks at the letterheads of the magnates who write, and at the financial ratings of those who protest, and at the membership of the organizations whose responsible heads hysterically demand retraction. And always in the background, there is the threat of boycott, a threat which has practically sealed up the columns of every publication in America against even the mildest discussion of the Jewish question. That's certainly true today.
Yeah, I was just going to say the same thing. I mean, there it is, you know. It was already going on then.
I've been through trying to get radio stations to have people on for interviews or to sell airtime for revisionist or white racialist radio programs. And that Jewish pressure makes a big difference. It comes in various forms. I remember I had contacted WINB, which was a shortwave station, about getting Ernst Zundel on there. Mm-hmm. And they agreed to run the program. But then they had a Jewish employee that said he was going to quit if they did that. And they...
An employee? He must have been an important employee. He must not have been the janitor or anything. He must have been a manager, maybe.
But I think that one employee, I don't know, must have raised a huge stink or must have somehow had that radio station, you know, by the short and curlies, because I can't understand that, just because one employee doesn't like it.
Well,
I'll tell you another thing. The revisionism is really the thing that they fear the most.
It's true. That's true. And people need to say that. They can say that with confidence, because it's absolutely true. All right, let's go on.
The Jewish question in America cannot be concealed forever by threats against publications, nor by the propagandist publication of matter extremely and invariably favorable to everything Jewish. It is here, and it cannot be twisted into something else by the adroit use of propaganda, nor can it be forever silenced by threats. The Jews of the United States can best serve themselves and their fellow Jews all over the world by letting drop their far too ready cry of anti-Semitism, by adopting a franker tone than that which befits a helpless victim, and by seeing what the Jewish question is and how it behooves every Jew who loves his people to help solve it.
Well, that's idealistic, isn't it?
It sure is. He thinks that the Jews are going to be reasonable.
Yeah.
If he just talks to them like a reasonable person. You might find one here and there that has some inclination to do that, but a lot of them are afraid. I mean, when you do find a reasonable Jew, you'll find that reasonable Jew says, look, I can't do this. Look at David Cole there. He ended up getting threatened by JDL.
Yes. And so badly. They scared him so badly that he actually just disappeared. and has never been seen since.
Yeah, and they have it in their religion, this thing called Mezira. A Jew should not, if they're Orthodox Jews, the Jew should not testify in court against a fellow Jew, not in a non-Jewish court. So,
right,
I mean, they have
which
this.
Which is a kind of illegal thing. I mean, that doesn't hold water in our societies, but they get away with it. This is all, you know, it's just too outrageous for words. Well, let's go
say,
on.
Yeah, criminal conspiracy is in the Jewish religion.
Yeah, it is. It is. Anything to protect ourselves and to have a close, not hurt another Jew is their religion. And therefore, I don't know. He gets into religion here a little bit, not too much.
But. All right. There has been used in this series the term international Jew. It is susceptible of two interpretations. One, the Jew wherever he may be. The other, the Jew who exercises international control. The real contention of the world is with the latter and his satellites, whether Jew or Gentile. Now, this international type of Jew, this grasper after world control, this actual possessor and wielder of world control, is a very unfortunate connection for his race to have. The most unfortunate thing about the international Jew, from the standpoint of the ordinary Jew, is that the international type is also a Jew. And the significance of this is that the type does not grow anywhere else than on a Jewish stem. There is no other racial nor national type which puts forth this kind of person. It is not merely that there are a few more Jews among international financial controllers. It is that these world controllers are exclusively Jews. That is the phenomenon which creates an unfortunate situation for those Jews who are not and never shall be world controllers, who are the plain people of the Jewish race. If world control were mixed, like the control, say, of the biscuit business, then the occasional Jews we might find in those higher financial altitudes would not constitute the problem at all. The problem would then be limited to the existence of world control in the hands of a few men of whatever race or lineage they might be. But since world control is an ambition which has only been achieved by Jews, and not by any of the methods usually adopted by would-be world conquerors, it becomes inevitable that the question should center in that remarkable race. And there you have the irony of accusing Hitler of wanting to take over the world.
Yeah. But, of course, if you say that the Jews want to take over the world, well, that's such a slander, anti-Semitism.
Or if they already have.
Yeah. Well, this is some of the strong talk that I thought was pretty good in here, where he makes it very clear that when he talks about this Jewish type of person that doesn't grow anywhere else than on a Jewish stem, making it very clear that they are a very unique type of human being, like no one else. And this, so, you know, which can't then say, well, they're just people like everyone else, you know.
Yes, he's saying that you ordinary Jews really ought to distance yourself from your crooked elite.
Yeah, but see, these ordinary Jews aren't so ordinary after all. I mean, they like this crooked elite. They like knowing that there are all these rich, powerful Jews. Makes them feel safer and more secure, and they're going to do what they say in order to protect all of them. So
they're sticking together with their leaders.
Right, right. And so this idea
reminds me of what Hitler said about how all the Jews stick together like burrs.
Yes, well, he said a lot of good things. Other people have too. I mean, people all kinds of people notice this. Well, let's go on.
This brings in another difficulty. in discussing this group of world controllers under the name of Jews, and they are Jews, it is not always possible to stop and distinguish the group of Jews that is meant. The candid reader can usually determine that, but the Jew who is in a state of mind to be injured is sometimes pained by reading as a charge against himself what was intended for the upper group. Then why not discuss the upper group as financiers and not as Jews, may be asked. Because they are Jews. It is not to the point to insist that in any list of rich men there are more Gentiles than Jews. Well, that was back then. Now it's different. We are not talking about merely rich men who have, many of them, gained their riches by serving a system. We are talking about those who control, and it is perfectly apparent that merely to be rich is not to control. The world-controlling Jew has riches, but he also has something much more powerful than that. The international Jew, as already defined, rules not because he is rich, but because, in a most marked degree, he possesses the commercial and masterful genius of his race, and avails himself of a racial loyalty and solidarity, the like of which exists in no other human group. In other words, transfer today the world control of the international Jew to the hands of the highest commercially talented group of Gentiles, and the whole fabric of world control would eventually fall to pieces. Because the Gentile lacks a certain quality, be it human or divine, be it natural or acquired, that the Jew possesses. This, of course, the modern Jew denies. There is a new position taken by the modernists among the Jews, which constitutes a denial that the Jew differs from any other man, except in the matter of religion. Jew, they say, is not a racial designation, but a religious designation, like Episcopalian, Catholic, Presbyterian. This is the argument used in newspaper offices in the Jews' protests against giving the Jewish designation to those of their people who are implicated in the crime. You don't give the religious classifications of other people who are arrested, the editor is told. Why should you do it with Jews? The appeal to religious tolerance always wins, and is sometimes useful in diverting attention from other things. That business of regarding Jews as only a religious group goes back to Napoleon, I believe, because there was he had the Jews. I haven't read about this recently, but there was. Some occasion when Napoleon, I guess he had some Jewish organization decide whether the Jews were French people or not. Are the Jews only a religion, or are you a different nationality? And we are people of French nationality and Jewish religion is how it came out. Okay, so then we're going to pretend that Judaism is just a religion, Jewishness is just a religion. And that they're really members of whatever nation in which they happen to live.
Yeah, that's the trick they play. Now, this is where I was reading something earlier in a National Socialist text, and I copied this sentence. National Socialism sees the Jewish question not as a religious problem, but rather as a racial question. And they're very clear on that. And, of course, that's true. They were absolutely right, because they're always trying to pass themselves off as a religion. And I love this thing. Well, you don't give the religion of other people when they commit a crime. Why would you say that they were a Jew? They're still doing that.
Yep. It's Enlightenment thinking, this idea that it goes back again to this business of regarding Jewishness as external and not essential.
Yeah. Okay.
And, you know, of course, we have sociobiology. Kevin McDonald, you know, the whole premise of that is that it's much deeper.
Sure
it
is.
There's hereditary.
And then
Jewish
sometimes
psychology.
They admit that. Well, they're admitting that more and more now. They sit around and brag. They go around and write these things, brag about what a great race they are and all that they've accomplished and how amazing they are. And then at the same time, they don't want you to be able to do it. They don't want the media to call them a race or talk about how well they've done or anything. So they're just totally dishonest.
Right. Right. Jews can talk about the Jews. Non-Jews only can talk about Jewish people.
Yeah.
Well, if the Jews are only religiously differentiated from the rest of the world, the phenomenon grows stranger still. For the rest of the world is interested less in the Jews' religion than in anything else that concerns him. There is really nothing in his religion to differentiate the Jew from the rest of mankind, as far as the moral content of that religion is concerned. And if there were, he would have overcome that by the fact that his Jewish religion supplies the moral structure for both of the other great religions. This is where I think there's a bit of an influence of Freemasonry, because the higher degrees of Scottish Rite Freemasonry seem to present Judaism as the foundation of all religions.
Oh, yeah. And this is, I don't know if it's Freemasonry, but it's everywhere. I mean, the religions do it. I mean, it's just this is what we're taught. If you take religion courses, I never took one, they used to be about the three great religions, and, you know, first came Judaism, and then the other two came from that, and blah, 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 you know, and making them all so important is the whole foundation of justice and truth and light and God and one God and everything in the whole entire world. They started it all. They didn't.
Yeah,
kind of
as a matter of fact,
everything.
Judaism, Judaism is an amalgam of other religions. It gets a lot of its doctrine from an ancient Persian religion.
Yeah.
That's why Friedrich Nietzsche wrote about Zarathustra. Zarathustra was supposed to be the founder of the ancient Persian religion, and he used the name of the founder of that religion to reverse everything that he started. In other words, the ancient Zarathustra started all this stuff that became Judaism and then eventually Christianity. So he uses the same name for his character to say, basically, I take it all back.
Yeah.
That's why he used the name Zarathustra.
Okay. I read that, but I don't remember that part. I don't remember knowing that was
Yeah,
the name.
He may not have known it.
The name. No.
Okay.
It was a long time.
Moreover, oh, by the way, this thing about all religions really being one, that I think Freemasonry may have had that idea before Jews had anything to do with Freemasonry, because ancient paganism, ancient European paganism, had that idea. But with
that
paganism,
there was only one spirituality, sort of, and one God. Is that what you mean? That
in ancient European paganism, the unity of all religions was Platonism.
Well, they didn't call it Platonism, did they?
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. The more educated Christians were Platonists, and Christianity was seen as one of the masks of Platonism.
Okay.
Before the prevalence of Christianity, there were others. Okay, we'll continue. Moreover, it is stated that there are among English-speaking nations 2 million Jews who acknowledge their race and not their religion, while 1 million are classed as agnostic. Are these any less Jews than the others? The world does not think so. The authoritative students of human differences do not think so. An Irishman who grows indifferent to the church is still an Irishman. And it would seem to be equally true that a Jew who grows indifferent to the synagogue is still a Jew. He at least feels that he is, and so does the non-Jew.
Well, that's absolutely so. I mean, that's, you know, nobody would dispute that, hardly.
A still more serious challenge would arise if this contention of the modernists were true, for it would necessitate the explanation of these world-controlling Jews by their religion. We should have to say, they excel through their religion. And then the problem would turn on the religion whose practice should bring such power and prosperity to its devotees. But another fact would intervene, namely that these world-controlling Jews are not notably religious. And still another fact would hammer for recognition, namely the most devout believers and most obedient followers of the Jewish religion are the poorest among the Jews.
Here we go again.
If you want Jewish orthodoxy, the bracing morality of the Old Testament, you will find it not among the successful Jews who have Unitarianized their religion to the same extent that the Unitarians have Judaized their Christianity, but among the poor in the side streets who still sacrifice the Saturday business for their Sabbath keeping. Certainly, their religion has not given them world control. It's not given them world control. Instead, they have made their own sacrifices to keep it inviolate against modernism.
Well, he's being very, very, these writers are being very, very kind. But, you know, this is where it's dated because times have changed. But it's interesting to see how it was then. But you don't find there are still Orthodox Jews and serious Sabbath keeping Jews and so on. But I don't know how much it interferes with their business. They want the world to make Saturday the holy day. That's what they want to suit
perhaps
themselves.
But some of those Orthodox Jews do seem to be odd men out sometimes. There were some Orthodox Jews that went to that International Revisionist Conference in Iran.
They are. They're not wanted amongst the rest of the Jews, and they're heretics, you know.
They're non-Zionist Orthodox Jews. They think all the others are heretics.
Yeah. But they don't appeal to me too much either.
Yeah. Of course, if the Jew differs from the rest of mankind only when he is in full accord with his religion, the question becomes very simple. Any criticism of the Jew becomes sheer religious bigotry and nothing else. And that would be intolerable. But it would be the consensus of thoughtful opinion that the Jew differs less in his religion than in anything else. There is more difference between the two great branches of Christianity, more conscious difference than between any branch of Christianity and Judaism. You know what? I can't make logical sense of that.
No, I don't either. Let's just skip that. That's just the way they were thinking then when they took all that stuff more seriously than we do today.
I also don't agree with the assertion from the previous paragraph that the morality of Christianity and the morality of Judaism are the same.
Church people used to think that, and they say that. A lot of them still do. Oh, a whole lot of them still do. Look at all the Christian Zionists. So that is a general thought, and actually you don't have it, and I don't have it either, but, you know, that's... I don't think many of our listeners do, so we don't have to worry about that.
You have to be unaware of the Talmud to say that.
Yeah, that's right.
So that, the contention of certain modernists notwithstanding, the world will go on thinking of the Jew as a member of a race whose persistence has defeated the utmost efforts made for its extermination.
Mm-hmm.
A race that has preserved itself in virility and power by the observance of those natural laws, the violation of which has mongrelized so many nations. A race which has come up out of the past with the two great moral values which may be reckoned on, monotheism and monogamy. A race which today is before us as the visible sign of an antiquity to which all our spiritual wealth harks back. Nay, the Jew will go on thinking of himself as the member of a people, a nation, a race. And all the mixture and intermixture of thought or faith or custom cannot make it otherwise. A Jew is a Jew, and as long as he remains within his perfectly unassailable traditions, he will remain a Jew. And he will always have the right to feel that to be a Jew is to belong to a spiritual race.
Superior race.
Didn't I say that?
You said spiritual.
superior race.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, basically they're saying that the Jews are not are a race, and all this talk about them being a religion is just that. It's just their talk.
Just a couple points here. We do not owe monogamy to the Jews.
No.
The Greco-Roman civilization was monogamous.
Well, you're right, and they are saying this here, that they've come up with, this race has come up with two great moral values. Yeah, monotheism and I don't think they even came up with monotheism. They didn't come
probably
up with that.
Probably not.
No.
Probably
they,
not.
And they take credit. Isn't that typical? That's what they do. They take credit for everything they can, and unfortunately they've gotten away with so much of it, probably because of their media control.
Yeah, I believe it's a long time ago that I read it, but I think Savitri Devi gives credit to one of the pharaohs for coming up with monotheism.
Oh, yeah, that's right. She does.
That, and also, he refers to, he says that the Jews have kept their race pure. Well, for people that spread over so many countries, relatively speaking, they've done a good job of keeping pure, but they're not a pure race. There's a book, the Genetics of the Jews by A.E. Morant. He says they have about 5% Negro blood.
5%? Would you think that's reliable? That book? Just because one book wrote it.
Well, but if you look at Jews, you can see a lot of them have kinky hair.
Oh, yeah, they do. They do. I guess kinky hair always comes from Negro, doesn't it? Doesn't come from anywhere else. Asians have straight hair. Indians have straight hair, too, unless they have Negro in them, then they can have kinky hair. So kinky hair is kind of a sign of Negro genes, huh?
You can see more or less Negro. If you look at Jews, a variety of Jews, you can see more or less Negro in them. Some of them have the kinky hair. Some of them don't. Some of them have almost flat noses. You know, you go down to wherever they live, they tend to pick up some of the local racial population. Coming from the Middle East, there was probably African slave trade through there back when they lived there.
Yeah, so the point is that all this talk about a pure race is just more of that. You know, it just isn't true either.
They try to maintain their stock such as it is pure, but they're not the pure ancient Israelites. That's not the case.
No, I don't think they are at all. Well, let's go on.
All right. These world-controlling Jews at the top of affairs, then, are there by virtue of, among other things, certain qualities which are inherent in their Jewish natures. Every Jew has these qualities, even if not in the supreme sense. Just as every Englishman has Shakespeare's tongue, but not in Shakespeare's degree. And thus it is impracticable, if not impossible, to consider the international Jew without laying the foundations broadly upon Jewish character and psychology.
Okay.
We may discount at once the too common libel that this greater form of Jewish success is built upon dishonesty. It is impossible to indict the Jewish people or any other people on a wholesale charge. No one knows better than the Jew how widespread is the notion that Jewish methods of business are all unscrupulous. There is no doubt a possibility of a great deal of unscrupulousness existing without actual legal dishonesty. But it is altogether possible that the reputation of the Jewish people have long borne in this respect may have had other sources than actual and persistent dishonesty. A little excuse-making here.
Mm-hmm.
Apologetics. We may indicate one of these possible sources. The Jew at a trade is naturally quicker than most other men. They say there are other races which are as nimble at a trade as is the Jew, but the Jew does not live much among them. In this connection, one may remember the famous joke about the Jew who went to Scotland.
Well, they don't tell the joke, so I don't know. I'm kind of curious what this
joke was,
but yeah, I would too.
Now, it is human nature for the slower man to believe that the quicker man is too deft by far, and to become suspicious of his deftness. Everybody suspects the sharper, even though his sharpness be entirely honest. The slower mind is likely to conceive that the man who sees so many legitimate twists and turns to a trade may also see and use a convenient number of illegitimate twists and turns.
I think that's very true. I was impressed by this. I think that's true. You know, slower people are kind of very suspicious of people who can do things faster and better. It just doesn't seem right to them, you know. It's kind of sweet in a way.
Seems credible, but maybe not the whole story. Moreover, there is always the ready suspicion that the one who gets the best of the bargain gets it by trickery, which is not above board. Slow, honest, plain-spoken, and straight-dealing people always have their doubts of the man who gets the better of it.
Well, you're right that it's not the whole story, but it is a human trait. It is a trait, but that's not the answer to the Jews.
The Jews, as the records for centuries show, were a keen people in trade. They were so keen that many regarded them as crooked. And so the Jew became disliked for business reasons, not all of which were creditable to the intelligence or initiative of his enemies. Take, for example, the persecution which Jew merchants once suffered in England. In older England, the merchant class had many easygoing traditions. One tradition was that a respectable tradesman would never seek business but wait for it to come to him. Another tradition was that to decorate one's store window with lights or colors, or to display one's stock of goods attractively in the view of the public, was a contemptible and underhanded method of tempting a brother tradesman's customers away from him.
I think that's just so funny. So funny, and I'm sure it's quite true. And just think about that. And yet, there's something nice about it, but we're so used to thinking that you do everything to sell as much as you can and make people want to come to you and be attractive. I mean, we don't see anything wrong with that, but to think that at one time it was considered unethical amongst our own people is very interesting to me. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to, I don't want to continue.
Yeah, we've not much time left.
Yeah.
Still another tradition was that it was strictly unethical and unbusinesslike to handle more than one line of goods. If one sold tea, it was the best reason in the world why he should not sell teaspoons. As for advertising, the thing would have been so brazen and bold that public opinion would have put the advertiser out of business. The proper demeanor for a merchant was to seem reluctant to part with his goods.
Isn't that funny? That's so funny.
One may readily imagine what happened when the Jewish merchant bustled into the midst of this jungle of traditions. He simply broke them all. In those days, tradition had all the force of a divinely promulgated moral law, and in consequence of his initiative, the Jew was regarded as a great offender. A man who would break those trade traditions would stop at nothing. The Jew was anxious to sell. If he could not sell one article to a customer, he had another on hand to offer him. The Jews' stores became bazaars, forerunners of our modern department stores, and the old English custom of one store for one line of goods was broken up. The Jew went after trade, pursued it, persuaded it. He was the originator of a quick turnover and small profits. He originated the installment plan. The one state of affairs he could not endure was business at a standstill, and to start it moving, he would do anything. He was the first advertiser in a day when even to announce in the public prints the location of your store was to intimate to the public that you were in financial difficulties, were about to go to the wall, and were trying the last desperate expedient to which no self-respecting merchant would stoop. It was as easy as child's play to connect this energy with dishonesty. The Jew was not playing the game, at least so the staid English merchant thought. As a matter of fact, he was playing the game to get it all in his own hands, which he has practically done. The Jew has shown that same ability ever since. His power of analyzing the money currents amounts to an instinct. His establishment in one country represents another base from which the members of his race could operate. Whether by the natural outworking of innate gifts or the deliberate plan of race unity and loyalty, all Jewish trading communities had relations. And as these trading communities increased in wealth, prestige, and power, as they formed relations with governments and great interests in the countries where they operated, they simply put more power into the central community wherever it might be located, now in Spain, now in Holland, now in England. Whether by intention or not, they became more closely allied than the branches of one business could be, because the cement of racial unity, the bond of racial brotherhood, cannot, in the very nature of things, exist among the Gentiles as it exists among the Jews. Gentiles never think of themselves as Gentiles, and never feel that they owe anything to another Gentile as such. Thus, they have been convenient agents of Jewish schemes at times and in places when it was not expedient that the Jewish controllers could be publicly known. But they have never been successful competitors of the Jew in the field of world control.
This idea, of course, we all know this, but Gentiles don't think of, we don't think of ourselves as Gentiles, or even if we had a name for ourselves, our own name, we don't think of ourselves that way, and we don't think of owing anything to one another. But then, as things have changed now, as the times are getting, everything is turning around, we're starting to do that.
From these separated Jewish communities went power to the central community where the master bankers and the master analysts of conditions lived. And back from the central community flowed information of an invaluable character and assistance wherever needed. It is not difficult to understand how, under such a condition, the nation that did not deal kindly with the Jews was made to suffer, and the nation that yielded to them their fullest desire was favored by them. And it is credibly stated that they have made certain nations feel the power of their displeasure. This system, if it ever existed, exists in greater power today. It is today, however, threatened as it never has been. 50 years ago, international banking, which was mostly in control of the Jews as the money brokers of the world, was on top of business. It exercised the super control of governments and finance everywhere. Then came that new thing, industry.
Well, we've run out of time, Hattie.
Well, let me just finish it off here.
Well, this is kind of complex. We can pick it up next week. Yeah.
What he says is that industry came into competition with finance for domination of economies.
Right. Well, and so we'll start here. Right. We'll start here next week, and then we can talk about this a little more because it is important. And let's see how much. We're almost to the end. There's very little. Yeah, but still, you wouldn't have been able to finish it off. So we will finish this little part. And next week, ladies and gentlemen, we will do that. Then we'll start chapter 5, which is anti-Semitism. Will it appear in the U.S.? And we'll see. Pretty long, so we might take 2 weeks to do that. Thank you for listening. Come back again next week for another episode. Thanks, Hattie.
Hooray, Jake, hooray, John, breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.